I had open heart surgery a number of years ago. I was so happy to wake up after that surgery. It gave me a new perspective on that day that I woke up to, because there was no guarantee that I would wake up.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Yes, good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm really delighted to have, you know, a wonderful guest, friend and colleague. And as always, he will introduce himself. So, David, can you please go ahead?
Thank you, Maurice. My name is David Hales. I'm a trustee at the Parliament of the World Religions. I chair the board of trustees of Future Generations University, and in addition to those roles, try to stay busy on other things. It's an honor and a pleasure to be part of the Walk, Talk, Listen podcast. I've admired Maurice for a long time.
David, you know, I think for the listeners, it would be very interesting to hear you explain a little bit about what the Parliament of World Religions is. So, because that's kind of fascinating.
The Parliament actually started in 1893 with a convocation at the Chicago World's Fair of religious leaders who came together really for the first time in the history of the last 2,000 years to look at common elements of faith across religions, taking dogma aside and looking at the basic values that underlie the positions that different faith dogmas take or faith systems take. The Parliament was reconvened in 1993, a long intervention of time, 100 years, but the basic purpose of the Parliament is to bring together advocates of various faith systems, focused on finding common ground, focused on finding the things on which all people of faith can agree in, and focused on taking actions to promote those basic values.
Wow, yeah, and I think it's absolutely a great network or gathering of people, as you said, of different faiths, and having really important discussions on how to make this world a little bit better, more sustainable, and more peaceful. So, I would really encourage for the listeners who are not familiar with the Parliament for World Religions to really check out the website and see the excellent activities and discussions that are going on. David, I would like to go to, you know, you as a person, because you have had different hats, you know, within your career. I kind of see politics, science, religion. So for me, it seems that you kind of have married truth and meaning, or, you know, are dancing with truth and meaning in your lives. Can you explain a little bit, you know, if I'm right with that observation, that's what you do in your life, dancing with truth and meaning.
I love that. I've never put those terms together as I've been trying to describe who I am and what I've done. But I really like the image, because when you dance, you stumble, particularly if you're me. You make a misstep here and there. It's not a hard pattern. It is an interaction that's ongoing, and it's an interaction that evolves over time. And for me, as I hear that phrase, I think that it involves partners. And it involves so many partners. And in the interaction of those partners is the opportunity to learn, which goes to the title, of course, of your podcast. Mm-hmm. To me, the most important word there is listen, but it's not just listen to other people and the voices of other humans. It does include that, and that's an intense activity for one to engage in. It's not kind of waiting to pick out a few things that you agree with and what someone is saying to you. It's really trying to understand them. But to me, it also understands listening to the world around us, to the universe around us, which speaks to us in so many different ways. It speaks to us by the temperature on our skin. It speaks to us by the force of the wind that's blowing across. It has its own voice, which we can hear. And in many ways, it also speaks to us by its silence at times. So listening to me is something that I've tried to develop a skill at as I've gotten older. To take myself out of the equation, or at least minimize self within the equation, but to try to be open to all of God's creation, to try to be open particularly to loved ones, particularly to family. Of course, it starts there. Particularly with colleagues and others, but also to seek out new voices and new ways of thinking and things that will actually challenge the sandcastles that one builds up in one's mind as you go along. And we think those sandcastles represent reality. And every once in a while, someone will come through with an observation that makes you just kind of wipe out all those sandcastles and start recreating and building that over again. And to me, that is an obligation of living an enlightened life, to be willing to always question how those sandcastles look, how one's own view of reality looks, and always be open to bringing in other points of view. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to me to be to not believe in anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean to have some kind of values that are conditioned by current situations and that change over time. I do believe that there is a core of values, and that core should lead to decisiveness in action. But as one does that, one should take that task of living as a very serious task, but never take oneself too seriously in its pursuit.
Yeah, something that you said in the beginning, listen is key, and you know that when you're getting older, you're getting, you think you're getting better at that. I realized when I started this podcast that I am miserable at listening, because I had to start, you know, after I recorded the conversation, I had to start like four or five times. And I was like, oh, that was an interesting conversation. which I did not hear, you know, the first time that I had spoken with my guests. So I hope also the listeners will hear that the podcasts are getting better in terms of, you know, my listening skills.
I'm envious, by the way, yeah, of the opportunity that you have to engage with articulate and thoughtful people, at least some articulate and thoughtful people. It's you're a lucky man.
No, I feel so privileged and humbled by that, you know. Actually, most people are saying yes when I invite them, and so that's really, really great. And something else of what you just said is what I hope this podcast is doing, also, you know, showing the different perspectives, and then that people realize that, you know, and that's something that the philosopher Ken Wilber has said, nobody can be wrong 100% of the time. So, you know, that means that there is always an opportunity to start a dialogue and to see if you can, you know, walk or dance together,
in the phrase that many people use, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yes, I didn't know that one. I like that. Yeah. Hey, David, to go back to kind of, you know, more your political career, because can you tell a little bit about then how you used within that environment your both your science and your religion in terms of because there you often have to speak, right? And or is also listening there you know, skill that is required?
That's a very interesting thing, at least interesting for me to reflect on over a adult working career of more than 50 years. I've worn many hats. All of those hats focus on the question of sustainability. And to me, a key element in sustainability is justice. I've had different positions, worked for a state park system, worked for the federal government, negotiated on environmental issues for the United States. I've been the director of the university or of the state of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. Had wonderful jobs, wonderful learning experiences. And it's kind of started out for me as an emphasis on what used to be called conservation, mm-hmm, which now we often phrase as stewardship, mm-hmm, and usually refer to in some context of sustainability. All of those things are the same topic to me. And it's about the future. It's always about the future. And it's about legacy. It is about the world that we shape with our choices, how we contribute to those major choices, and what the relevance of those are for those who will follow us. We inherited a world from our parents and grandparents. It was a bountiful and beautiful world, but still diminished compared to what it was 500 years ago. But it was continuous. We could see, we could understand, I could understand the world that my grandparents grew up in. I think we face a time now, because of the increased influence of human activity on the world around us, where we seriously run the risk of breaking that tie between generations, of creating a world where our great-grandchildren will have no way to understand what our great-grandparents experienced. And it's as if we don't miss the dinosaurs in our daily life. We don't look out the window and wish we could see one, because we've never seen one. We don't really know what one is. Our great-grandchildren, if we continue in the direction that we're going now with what many call the Anthropocene, may not have the ability to even understand what they're missing in the world. They may not know what silence is. They may not be able to have any personal experience with wild systems that are sustainable in their own right. And that's a great concern to me. And to, for me, that's at the core of conservation. It's at the core of stewardship. It's at the core of sustainability. It's at the core of justice. It's that continuity, which is now the responsibility of those of us who are alive. We've inherited it from others who lived before us, and we need to pass it on with as much integrity as possible to those who will live after us.
Yeah, well, I wanted to take a moment for the listeners to have that sink in, and I, and you know, there is a lot of work, hard work for us to do. I'm excited actually, and still hopeful if I see how, you know, the younger generation is, you know, working and challenging us as a world. So I'm still hopeful. And maybe later in the conversation, we can talk a little bit about, you know, the younger generation. David, you know, you know that one of the reasons is that I started this podcast is that I walk 100 miles in a year for the last, I've done that now for the last 9 years. I do that to raise awareness and funds for, you know, hunger and poverty issues. If you would be asked to walk 100 miles in a week, what is the cause that you would walk for?
I think that is a fascinating question, and I've been wrestling with it ever since you asked me that question the first time. And I'll give you an answer which perhaps is not direct. And my answer to that is that anything I believe in strongly should be worth walking 100 miles. It would be hard for me to pick out one thing and say, okay, that's the one I would walk 100 miles for, with the implication being that for others, I would only walk 99 miles or 60 miles or 70 miles. To me, values are living things that should condition actions. Love is a transitive verb. It's not intransitive. It's not something that exists off in the ether somewhere. It is a set of actions that exist between us or between anything, between us and anything that we love, whether it's the forest around us or the other animals with whom we share this particular planet. So my answer to your question, which may be unsatisfying to you, is that anything you believe in strongly should be worth walking 100 miles. That may mean we'd be walking a lot, but that's the nature of the obligation and responsibility that we face, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I'm not surprised by that answer, David. Because if people would check out what you have been doing and what you're still doing, is you know, you seem to refuse to pick one over the other because you're busy with all. So, thanks for sharing that. What drives you? What is the ultimate drive for you? You know, to keep on going.
For me, it's a deep appreciation and gratitude for the experience of living. I had open heart surgery a number of years ago. I was so happy to wake up after that surgery. It gave me a new perspective on that day that I woke up to, because there was no guarantee that I would wake up. And it gave me a sense of vividness and color and richness about the new day that was tangible. And I realized that that was more a mark of my own inadequacy before, perhaps, because all of us should wake up to every day, to every experience as an opportunity for joy, for engagement beyond ourselves, which ultimately is about ourselves. It's ultimately about our relationship to those things. So what drives me, I think, is the appreciation for life, for engagement, for relationships, and recognizing that that means so much to me that I have an obligation to try to make those experiences for every human being as rich as possible, and to make sure that what I do doesn't take away choices from my children and my grandchildren. We can take actions now. We are powerful enough as a species that can preclude options and choices from future generations. Our responsibility is to not do that, is to try to maintain. When you talk about what we're conserving choices. What are we stewarding? We're stewarding that range of choices so that every person can be the author of their own story. And the more that means to me, the more I realize how much it means to me, the more responsibility I feel to recognize that that means the same thing to you, to everybody who's listening to this, to all of the people that will follow in future generations. And that if we join together to maintain those choices, recognizing that that richness of life is a basic possession of every human being, then that begins to both give me joy, but also motivate me to try to do the best I can with what I have in the time that I'm alive.
Oh, yeah, that's beautifully phrased, David. You know, yeah, I would like to take you to the younger generation, because you actually, you know, when you talk, you talk a lot about your children and your grandchildren. And when I walk, you know, I'm often accompanied by different folks, older and younger. Strangely enough, we end up talking often about religion and spirituality, and then we quickly go to the younger generation and how they perceived it. So I would like to ask you also, what are your thoughts on the youth and religion and spirituality? Do you see a change in the way they experience that? Or are you saying, no, not real? A difference, maybe it's a difference around institutionalization of religion and spirituality, or it's the same. So what do you see? What are your observations, and what is your opinion around it?
Well, I can only see a very narrow slice of that future generation. And I can only interpret from a narrow range of direct and vicarious experiences. Mm-hmm. But it does seem to me that we some of us are not young anymore, but the young have the first opportunity in human history to create societies that are sustainable and just. There's more knowledge available. There are more riches available. The technology has advanced so that much of what we decide we want to do, we can do. The question is whether there is a will to do that. And so of the young people that I've been privileged to know and observe as a college president, as a chair of trustees of a university, as in my daily works, and of course the ones that I would hope I know best, and that would be my own children and grandchildren. There's no question that they are incredibly capable, or at least they have the opportunity to become incredibly capable. The knowledge available to them is much greater. Knowledge in the sense of fact and science. There's also some false fact out there as well. What remains an open question to me is whether they understand the meaning of purpose in life and the value of purpose to them, and what the overall commitment of that generation is to use those tools which they have for something beyond themselves, and in a way that is the most fulfilling to themselves. And to me, those two things come together. I think it's an open question for every generation. I'm a philosophically a traditional conservative. I don't think humankind has changed much, that the moral arc of our civilization may be bending in one direction or another, but the people who exist at any given time are essentially what humans have always been. And I think we've not evolved beyond our forebears, and our children will not evolve much differently from us. I think there is a basic human nature. And certainly one can look at any generation and find different manifestations of the way that they live. It's very difficult to generalize, but what is clear to me is that the opportunity that generations of humans now have to do good or evil is much greater than I had when I was growing up or my grandparents had, not in your personal life because that doesn't change, but the overall impact of how we engage with our society and how we act as a species rather than as individuals. And to me, the guide for living now is that one's responsibility is equal to one's opportunity. The more opportunity you have, the more responsibility you have. If you can change something, you're responsible for deciding whether to change it or not. Mm-hmm. If you can affect something, you're responsible for making that decision as to how to affect it. If that possibility is available to you, you're responsible for doing the hard work of learning that makes the exercise of that opportunity possible. And so what's clear most of all of this is that the challenge for young people coming along is much greater than the challenge that you and I faced. It is very clear now what happens if we do not change the way we're behaving as a species on this planet. We have a much clearer view, this generation has a much clearer view of what will happen if we do not make major changes in the way we behave. With that possibility of observing that comes a great deal of responsibility to choose. Mm-hmm. And that challenge is, I think, perhaps increasing with every generation. Mm-hmm.
Recently, you were part of making a publication of Faith for Earth, right? It's called.
Yes.
Can you tell a little bit about the publication and why you were part of it and what you hope this particular publication will do? Because I think it really speaks to, you know, your passion and your desire to really work on, you know, conservation or sustainability. I see a product of as a result of the dance that you're doing. So, David, can you explain about the publication?
Well, Faith for Earth is, I love this. I thank you for introducing the concept of dancing. It is a dance. The book is a dance, or it represents a dance. My co-author in this book is someone whom you know as well, wonderful lady, Kusumita Peterson.
Absolutely.
Who is a scholar of faith and religions. She's many things, and that's not a fair characterization, but we wouldn't have time to go into all of the things that Kusumita is. But our hope in doing this was to provide an introduction for people who are curious about the relationships between faith and faith systems and earth systems. And so what we've tried to do in a very short book is take many, certainly not all, of the faith systems, but many which are prominent and well known to people, and look at the basic teachings of those faith systems, mm-hmm. the parts that are much in common with the basic teachings of all of the others. And we've tried to take a look at the impact of humans on earth systems. What we're facing now with the challenge of the Anthropocene era, the point where humans have become a force of geological proportions. And to provide nothing more in this book than the introduction to those relationships in the hope that it will enable more enlightened decisions about the interaction between the human impact on earth systems and the actions which we should take based on our faith systems. Initial feedback has been positive. It's absolutely, mm-hmm. if you'll pardon the advertisement.
No, and where can people find then the especially online version?
Go to the website of the Parliament of the World Religions, mm-hmm. parliamentoftheworldreligions.org.
I'm bringing you back to your dance. You know, because with a dance of, in your case, the truth and meaning, music is linked with that. So if I would ask you to mention a song or a piece of music that embodies what you are about, what piece of music or song would that be?
That's also a wonderful question. And I have, as a side note, an observation about dancing. My favorite partner, of course, is my wife and life partner, Barbara. One of the characteristics of our dancing is the battle over who gets to lead. and any good dance involves some kind of cooperative interaction, or it is perhaps not as fluid as it could be. The song which I eventually focused on in response to your question is Steppenwolf's Monster. Now, there's no way I could dance to that song. I don't know that Steppenwolf could be danced to by someone of my age and physical abilities. But this is a song which from the 60s on seems to me to be relevant to the challenges that are faced particularly by citizens of the United States about America, about truth and honesty in looking at our own history, but about the ultimate hope which is embodied in a system of democracy and a system in a system wherein people can write their own stories. So I would say Steppenwolf's Monster. And I hope none of this comes across as a message. Hmm. It's introspection. Literally as we talk, I'm trying to concentrate on the weaknesses of what I'm saying, how I wish I had said it differently, but also to your reaction as we're talking about it. So I don't presume to have a message for your listeners, but an invitation. And that's to engage, to be very, as we are all very conscious that today we will write a new chapter in the story that is our lives. And we can control in many ways how that story evolves. So it is an invitation to engage with what may have been heard on this broadcast. You and I can know what we intend to say, but we don't know what's heard on the other end of it. For me, perhaps this is the beginning of conversations, beginning of interaction, beginning of listening. In many ways, and to me, my obligation is more to listen than to send a message.
Thanks, David, for your time and really your, you know, sharing your thoughts, observations, and your experience. For me, it's always a delight to listen to you and as I mentioned to you, I try to become a better listener. So because I really believe if you're better at listening, as you also, I think, alluded to, you know, there is a better chance of, and that's really necessary nowadays, I think, unite broadly and act boldly, because those are also two steps that are really necessary more than ever, I think, in this challenging world and
dance with joy
and dance with joy
and yeah. dance with joy you know embrace
yeah
I embrace the opportunity of every day and every opportunity and be joyful with it.
I was thinking about your remark in terms of, you know, dancing and the issue of who will lead. Well, first of all, I'm from the generation that don't necessarily, you know, will do the waltz or the tango, and because we were more, you know, dancing by ourselves together, which is maybe, you know, a sign of how we, you know, took care of each other and the planet. But if I would dance with my wife, you know, a waltz or a tango. I'm pretty sure she would give me the idea that I was leading, but I wasn't really. So, yeah, David, thank you so much. Have a great rest of the day, and speak with you soon.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.